I'd like to do in the next 15 to 20 minutes is just give you an overview of the field of public health genomics and basically pressing a singular point, which is what is it and why should we care? There's so many other pressing public health issues. Of course, we've been doing public health genomics for 10 years at the CDC. We're celebrating our 10th year anniversary in January with a one-day symposium. Four things I'd like to do: review the status of genomics in 2007, and talk about the gap between scientific excitement and the population health impact, then briefly move on to describe the discipline of public health genomics, which is really trying to close that gap, and then I'll talk briefly about the translation, the genomics translation highway, and how public health is so crucial to that translation. Without public health, there will be no translation, just an alphabet soup of DNA. Then I'll mention briefly some of the salient CDC public health genomics initiative, and if you want more, you can always visit our website or talk to our people here. Jeanette and Sarah are in the audience, and we look forward for the genomics forum to get organized and get underway. We are formally in the genomics era. Since 2003, the Human Genome Project was finished, but we've really gone in 50 years from the double helix in 1953 to now in 2007, where the whole sequence of an individual human being, in this case Craig Venter, was sequenced, 3 billion base pairs. If you go to the PLOS Biology website, you can actually download his genome. I don't know what people do with that alphabet soup, but his genome is downloadable, and you can check all the sequences and the sequence variation. There are so many major initiatives going on at NIH, the Gene and Environment Health Initiative, sort of big science to try to discover gene-environment interaction and the etiology of all human diseases, basically. But basically, I try to remind myself, why are we doing this in public health? This is Madeline, a child who was diagnosed with PKU at birth because of the newborn screening program. And because of the newborn screening, she's healthy. She didn't lose any IQ points, but so many other kids were born with PKU and left to be mentally retarded because there was no newborn screening at the time. Now, newborn screening, I think, is going to be the exception in public health genomics, although it's now the largest and most established public health genetics program. But I think genetics is going to be integrated into the practice of medicine and healthcare in general in more ways than one. So what do you do with genes when you find one? And this is sort of the vision of medicine for the 21st century as elaborated by Elias Zerhouni, the director of NIH. Basically, what they're trying to do is uncover genetic variation that could predict, along with environmental factors, future risk of disease, and also personalize healthcare and disease prevention by creating smarter drugs or smarter vaccines or more early interventions. And then they use the word preemptive, which to us in public health, that's another word for prevention. And basically what this technology is purported to do is to try to accelerate and personalize more the healthcare delivery system and prevention strategies. Now, we have two major challenges that require immediate public health attention. The first one is what I call premature translation, or inappropriate translation. And this is a story that resulted after a couple of major groups discovered genes for heart disease back in May this year. And the caption in Reuters was as follows: a hunt for genes has found that people of Northern European descent have DNA that raises the risk for heart disease. Decode, which is one of the companies from Iceland, plans to bundle this discovery with other genetic variants into DNA-based tests for gauging inherited risk of heart attacks, the company said in a statement. So you have gene discovery and then rush to the goal, trying to sell it. Now, forgetting that there are so many steps in translation that needs to happen, including the population sciences, the behavioral and social sciences. We need to find out how many people have this variant. Is it different in different subgroups of the population? What is the population burden of heart disease? What does it interact with? What's the value added of testing? And can we actually construct this risk profile they're talking about? And genetic testing will become a public health issue. It is a public health issue today. If you look at the number of genetic tests that are available on the market, there are now about 1,500 of them. The number of laboratory tests that are offering genetic testing is increasing exponentially. And 90% of these genetic tests are for rare what we call single gene or genetic diseases. But the new category of genetic and genomic tests are actually coming online very fast for predicting drug response, for predicting the future heart disease or diabetes or asthma and what have you. So we need to be concerned about this, because it's going to, if not useful in public health, it's going to take some of the money away from other things that we can do. So we need to at least pay attention and figure out and be educated and figure out where we need to put our resources. So the question is, how good are these genetic tests? What are their benefits and harms? How can we assure the quality? So many questions that actually face the clinical healthcare enterprise right now, and public health are actually the honest broker in all of this. The second and major problem, which is nothing unique to genetics, is what I call the lost in translation problem, which is well known for other areas of medicine. And this is a paper by Claude L'Enfant, who used to direct the National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute and retired early on. And he gave so many examples in the field of cardiovascular disease in which so many things we know how to do, but we don't do them. Like a third of people who need aspirin for the prevention of heart attacks actually take aspirin. And he gave so many other examples, from physical activity to diet and smoking and other things. And he said at the end of that article, let's be realistic. If we couldn't do it with aspirin, how can we do it with DNA? Now, this is sort of a pessimistic view of things, but I'm more of an optimist. And I think if public health leadership gets up to the plate and actually begins to apply the population approach to this new technology, I think we'll all be better off. So what is public health genomics, and what is it trying to do? First, I'd like to give you sort of a pervasive feeling or some feeling in the public health community. And this is a paper by Ann Buchanan, published last year, that actually summarizes what some of you may be thinking. Like, if a minor fraction of the billions spent on technological research were spent instead on simpler things like, yes, early health education to improve diet and promote exercise, the benefits could grossly dwarf even the greatest plausible genetic successes. So, I'm with her. I always ask those same questions. Actually, we wrote this paper last year asking the questions, do we need genetic research for the prevention of common diseases with environmental causes? And the question is, it can be answered yes. And I think if we do not look at genomics as a tool, among many other tools, I think we'll be missing the boat. And actually, in my letter to the editor last year, to Ann Buchanan, I said, generic, let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater, because that's essentially what she was trying to do in that paper. And some of the public health thinking comes from Jeffrey Rose himself, who many years ago talked about sick individuals and sick populations. And many of us in this room still subscribe to the population approach, that we shouldn't really be going after the high-risk individuals. We should try to get everybody's cholesterol levels even down by a few points, because the impact on the population and heart attacks will be much larger. But what Jeffrey Rose said in his papers, and if you read it very carefully, he said, realistically, many diseases will continue to call for both approaches, and fortunately, competition between them is usually unnecessary. And that's something we forget in public health. We only take the title of Jeffrey Rose's article, but we don't read the fine print, as sometimes we don't. And that really brings me to the schism between medicine and public health. This is a paper we just recently published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, and we asked the question, will genomics actually widen that schism, or can it help heal the schism? And the schism is about healthcare versus population health, individuals, high risk versus the population, treatment versus prevention, the enamored approach with biomedical research versus our behavioral, social, and policy approaches in public health, genes versus environment. And to me, the answer is these two approaches should be complementary. And I think both medicine and public health could actually begin to weigh in on genomics. And public health has the tools to evaluate this technology, as I'll tell you in just a minute. So I like to think about public health as the population health mantra, rather than me in sitting in a government agency or some of you in states, but all of us working together to improve health through a population focus. Because no important health problem will be solved by medicine alone or public health alone. We have to work together. And these things apply to all areas of medicine, including public health. So over the last 10 years, this multidisciplinary field of public health genomics has emerged. And I think it provides our best strategy for appropriate applications of genomics in health practice. So what is it? What is public health genomics? It's a multidisciplinary field concerned with the effective and responsible translation of genome-based knowledge and technologies to improve population health, as opposed to medical genomics that is concerned with one person at a time. Our concern is about the population at large. We are concerned with gene-environment interaction and how we can leverage genetic technology to identify environmental causes of disease. We're interested in prevention and health promotion. We're interested in evidence-based applications. We are, of course, interested in health disparities. And this ELSI, which is sort of a code word for ethical, legal, and social implications of genomics. So what does the translation highway look like? And what does public health have to bring into it? This month in the Genetics and Medicine, I published this paper on the translation highway and looked at T1 through T4. Many of us, we think about two translation steps. The first one is from discovery to a clinical trial. This is what the NIH roadmap is trying to do, is get applications more and more from the bench to the bedside. And what we're trying to do is more move it across from a potential application to an evidence-based guideline, and then from a guideline to actual health practice, and then from health practice to measuring health impact on the population at large. We have a long way to go in terms of genomics, and we looked at the literature in this whole translation highway of the thousands, actually more than 500,000 articles in human genomics. Probably 2% or 3% are T2 and beyond. Actually, most of it is what I call T0 right now, which is focused on gene discovery. Very little of the pipeline is trying to move this technology from the clinic to the bedside to the population, trying to figure out how to use it, how not to use it, what's appropriate. And if you look at the evidence-based guidelines, there are only two over the last 6 years done, one on breast cancer, BRCA1, the other on hereditary hemochromatosis, and that's it. So what does public health have to bring to this translation highway, discovery to delivery from T1 to T4? First and foremost is a focus on prevention. That's what we do. And instead of bringing new technology that will increase healthcare costs, could we use this technology to actually reduce healthcare costs? That's a question. And that's a question that's reflected in this hypothetical case scenario that Francis Collins, the director of the Human Genome Institute, published in 1999, and he said that in the year 2010, this is what would be the practice of medicine. This is a hypothetical person named John who goes in for his checkup, and this is his genetic risk profile with increased risk for certain diseases and decreased risk for other diseases. And the idea is that you can use the whole spectrum of prevention, primary, secondary, and tertiary, to influence those risks of diseases. But what Francis did not say is, how do you get all these numbers? And if not the population sciences, public health sciences, coming in with these epidemiological parameters, whether or not genetic information will actually change people's behavior, how do you deliver information, outcome research, economic research, and on and on and on of all of these types of questions that could be asked. And because of that, I don't think 2010 is a realistic, we're just around the corner from 2010. If we're lucky and public health research gets up to the plate, I think we may be ready by 2025. The third area of this potential collaboration that I think is important is to sort of weigh the benefits and the harms, and what I call evidence-based knowledge integrations and guidelines development. I already told you that there is only two evidence-based guidelines in genetics, and because there is no data. The type of research that's done is mostly discovery-based, not application-based. So what we need to do is figure out the value added of genetic information. And I want to give you one example where, just to show you that genetics may not be as always trumped to be. So a couple of years ago, there was this article, a cohort study, that looked at a series of genes, and you don't even know, you need to know what they are, trying to predict in a cohort format the future of type 2 diabetes. And in their abstract, they made the claim, because of the strong data, and let me review it here with you, that depending on your BMI, if you have high BMI and have fasting blood glucose, and you have the wrong genetic variants, your risk for type 2 diabetes is much, much higher than if you don't have any of these factors. And what they said in their article is, maybe we should start screening people for type 2 diabetes on the basis of these genes. And so we did this sort of letter to the editor, and we asked the question. And one way to ask the question is, what's the value added of genetic information as opposed to other information? And one way to do this is this area under the curve analysis. And we modeled the findings of this paper, and want to cut the long story short and show you that, you know, that if you basically, the green is sort of what your prediction for type 2 diabetes by using just body mass index and fasting blood glucose. If you add the genes that's in basically all of them together, that's the black dot. And basically, there is really no value added. You could predict type 2 diabetes by looking at somebody and determining their BMI and actually looking at family history, which is much more predictive than any single genetic variant. And so in this case, at least, there is really no value added for doing genetic testing, because you can do an equally good job with other more proximal parameters or the combination of BMI and family history. And that question has to be asked again and again and again for every single genetic bit of information that comes our way in order to see how useful it is. And now we come to the bread and butter of public health, which is assessment, policy, and assurance. And this is sort of the core public health functions that are trying to deliver those services that are validated. A few years ago, we wrote this article in the American Journal of Public Health on using the IOM model of assessment, policy, and assurance for generics. And it hasn't really gone away. I guess that paper is still there. So in my last few minutes, and I know I'm running at 60 miles per hour or faster because there are two other wonderful speakers here, just want to give you quick updates on some major initiatives we have, and then I'll just basically go away. So so as you heard, our office was formed about 10 years ago. And our vision is to begin to use genetic knowledge to improve the lives and health of all people, a population approach. And the singular mission of our office is to work with every single program at CDC to figure out how and when to integrate genomics into research, policy, and programs. And I think over a period of 10 years, we've learned so much that 10 years ago I couldn't have anticipated. I mean, this explosion in science, especially in the last couple of years, has been unbelievable. So one major initiative we have is to conduct as many population studies as we can, because genes are discovered in a test tube, they're discovered in highly selected populations, and figuring out what they mean for the general population or subsets of the population is our biggest challenge. So what we have is a major project we call the U.S. Genome Profile that's based on NHANES. Some of you who know NHANES know that it is a nationally representative sample of the U.S. population, heavily weighted by racial and ethnic minorities. And for the last two NHANESes, they've been collecting DNA. So what we have now is a project that's ongoing to measure about 1 million genetic variants for each one of these 15,000 people, and then try to correlate, look at the prevalence of these genetic markers, but also correlate them with the 10,000 phenotypic or health endpoint variables that are already in this rich data set that has anything from your you know, height and weight to blood pressures, etc. At the same time, through collaboration and seed funding, we've tried to integrate genetics into across public health investigations, whether they're epidemic investigations or public health surveys. We held two major meetings on the role of human genomics in acute public health investigations in communities. We also had one on specifically related to influenza this year. And you can, if you visit our website, you can see the width and breadth of genetic studies that are being conducted in environmental health, in chronic disease and birth defects, in infectious disease control and epidemics. The second initiative we have is a worldwide initiative called the Human Genome Epidemiology Network, or HUGENET for short, that's trying to capture and synthesize this huge information, and huge is literally what this is all about. And what we've been trying to do is, by working with journals and networks of investigators, try to get the best science of what I call knowledge synthesis and meta-analyses of gene disease associations. And one of the things we do is track down the literature. Right now, over the last 6 years, we have more than 6,000 published articles on genetic associations every year, and a database of more than 30,000. The green refers to the subset of the article that look at gene-environment interactions. Still a minor fraction, but I suspect as time forward moves forward, most epidemiologic and environmental studies will begin to look at genetic components. And what we have is all under the huge navigator, something, a knowledge base that we launched recently that you can take a look at. The third major initiative is to figure out what to do with genetic information in practice. And this called the EGAP initiative is an independent, non-federal panel that commissions evidence-based reviews and evaluations and makes recommendations for what's ready for prime time. And again, as I told you earlier, the evidence practice field is not looking at genetics. Actually, they've only done two in the last 6 years. And what we wanted to do is not only to determine which ones are ready for applications, but more importantly, to identify the gaps in our knowledge, hence the word EGAP, and the gap in between, to try to feed the research enterprise that needs to be looked at. And these are the seven topics that the EGAP working group has been looking at. And you can see they range from cancer to mental health to pain management and cardiovascular disease, sort of truly true applications that go well beyond the traditional fields of newborn screening and MCH. And finally, some of our initiatives trying to integrate genetics into practice involve family history. I'll tell you about that in one slide. Enhancing state and local capacity. I'll tell you about that too. Also working with schools of public health to create centers for excellence in genomics and public health through our various reports and websites and competencies for genomic applications in public health. We try to do some of that. There are two current centers of genomics and public health. One of them is the University of Michigan. I think Toby is here, Toby Citron, and the University of Washington have been, for the last 5 years, actually trying to integrate genomics into public health curricula and trying to improve the knowledge base of public health professionals. We funded four states, mostly from the chronic disease programs, because MCH already has strong genetics presence focused on newborn screening and genetic services, but to try to look at genetics from the adult perspective and genomic tools was a little bit different. I think Ladine Larson is here from Utah, not sure if Minnesota, Oregon, and where's the last one? Michigan, I represent. And last but not least, I want to highlight to you a genomic tool that we all know and we all can measure, but very few of us use in practice, which is simple family history taking. And when I went to medical school, the only reason people taught me family history is to find people with single gene disorders. And I'm telling you, there is much more utility of family history from a population perspective if we look at the 50 or 60% of us in this room that have a close relative with heart disease, cancer, and diabetes, because we are at increased risk for those diseases. So we have developed a family tool for six diseases that's undergoing a clinical trial right now, collaborated with the Surgeon General, Richard Carmona, in launching Thanksgiving Day as Family History Day. And there is a free available web-based tool that you can download and you can use at the next Thanksgiving when you meet with your families trying to discuss matters of family and health. And last but not least, there is a big push right now in direct-to-consumer genetic tests. There are so many places on the internet that you can go and buy nutrigenomic tests. Basically, it tells you which food to eat or not. Regardless of your result, they want you to buy a certain nutraceutical, whatever it is. And we wanted to gauge the pulse of that. So we did a national survey, and then we worked with the three states that were part of our public health genomics capacity, using BRFSS, the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance, to look at awareness of these tests. Varies about 10 to 20% actual utilization of these tests. I mean, nationally we have 0.6%, Michigan and Oregon about, you know, somewhere around that ballpark. And, you know, if 0.5% of people, that's a lot of people on a national level, are spending money on these tests that have no utility, I think we're in for a long haul. So I want to close with this slide, because this slide captures the essence of what public health genomics is. We need to develop a population health approach that complements the medical enterprise that's trying to discover genes by keeping our eye on four things: focus on prevention and health promotion, and pick out the tools that seem to be appropriate for us. deploy the public health sciences, epidemiology, environmental health, behavioral and social sciences, to figure out what these genes mean for families and communities, and then abide by evidence practice development, which we all abide by, to try to develop the right policies around genetic information. And the ones that are ready for prime time, we should deploy all our public health resources to assess the needs of the population, develop the right policies, and then assure that the right services are given to the right people.